and applying ideas from, which are not really quantum information theory ideas, but the ideas which have been floating around the quantum information theory community, and applying them to understanding the information loss paradox. So I probably don't need to tell you that in ordinary quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, the evolution is unitary, and you might be interested in generalizing this for a number of reasons, one of which is the black hole evaporation process, but also you just might be interested in, there's the dictum that which is not forbidden is required, and therefore you might just be interested, can we have non-unitary evolution? And I should also say that in quantum measurement theory, there's also some people look at quantum measurement as being a non-unitary kind of information, a non-unitary sort of evolution. So both from the perspective of the black hole information paradox, but also from the perspective of just trying to generalize quantum field theory as much as possible, and from trying to understand quantum measurement, you might be interested in non-unitary field theory. So I'm just going to, but just to say the black hole information paradox in maybe a particularly striking way, and as a two-part paradox. So there's two parts to the black hole information paradox. The first part is that either information in the black hole is destroyed, in which case we have non-unitary evolution because we have destruction of information, or the information gets out through a causal horizon, in which case the evolution must also be non-unitary. And that's because we can't have a clone of a quantum state. So if we have information that somehow comes outside of a causal horizon, there will always exist a reference frame in which we have a single copy of a quantum state going to two copies of the quantum state. That's called, in quantum information theory, that's called cloning, and black hole people can call that the quantum Xerox principle, no Xeroxing principle. If you have a single copy of a state which involves two copies of the state, that can't happen by any unitary theory. So you have this weird thing that either the interaction must be non-unitary because of pure state evolves to a mixed state, or if information gets out, it also must be non-unitary.
How does that fit with what we just heard last talk?
Well, I think you either have to modify something on the semi-classical level, so you either have to basically not have the causal structure there, or so the information sometimes never gets beyond the causal horizon. That's probably what Don would say.
What Don would say is that because observables in quantum gravity are non-local, the information isn't really localized. So I would claim that indeed it's not a copying of the information to new degrees of freedom, it's just two operators that we might think of as being localized in different parts of the space-time that are actually related by the quantum gravitational constraints, and therefore can sample the same information, so there's no copying. So I see no reason why there needs to be non-unitarity in this process.
Right.
But I should let Jonathan proceed with his talk.
So I guess what I want to say is that, and nothing new, if we do have a unitary evolution, then we need some modification to what we think we know, so that we think we have a local observable, a local state, which can be on one side of a causal horizon on the other. That picture can't be holding. That's kind of the semi-classical picture must break down at some point. There's a part two to the paradox, because that in itself is not a paradox. The paradox only comes about if we don't like non-unitarity. We say we reject, for some reason, non-unitarity. So this paradox needs to have two parts. And so what we need to explore is whether there's a compelling reason to rule out non-unitary evolution. If there's not a compelling reason to rule out non-unitary evolution, then we might not be so worried about black hole evaporation. Because rejecting non-unitarity is also quite radical. We in some sense reject the causal structure, we might have remnants, we don't have the usual notion of a local observable, that sort of thing. So rejecting non-unitary evolution is very radical. Therefore, we need to explore whether we can have a non-unitary evolution. So I actually don't have a strong view on whether the evolution should be unitary or non-unitary. I think there's a lot of effort gone into unitary theories, like string theory, loop quantum gravity, there's a lot of effort being put into showing that the evaporation is somehow be unitary. But there hasn't been very much effort put into exploring, can we have a non-unitary evolution? There's, I could count maybe five papers that have been written on this. So I think it's important, even just from balancing out the views, to really explore whether we can have a non-unitary evolution.
Non-unitarity understates the problem with information cloning. Information cloning leads to non-linear evolution, not just non-unitary.
That's true.
Okay. Second of all, you can say there have been five papers, but there have been literally thousands of papers devoted to modifying quantum mechanics in a way that can accommodate non-unitarity, you know, in some framework.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there have been starting with Bohmian mechanics and you know, continuing to present day.
I guess it might be a question. What do you call? I mean, I think it's serious papers in this context. I think there's. I mean, I'll maybe go through the literature a little bit, but there's been some efforts to just say, look at decoherence, but not in kind of understanding what that really means from fundamental principles of. Well, it'll become apparent what I mean by really looking at whether you can have a non-unitary evolution. So I can certainly write down, the work on open quantum systems, for example, where you have a non-unitary evolution is huge. Mm-hmm. That's certainly true. But understanding whether you can have a fundamentally non-unitary evolution, whether it would violate, what of our cherished principles would violate, I think there hasn't been a lot of effort put into that, or at least in my view, not enough compared to the amount of work that's done on, say, string theory, loop quantum gravity, where you just assume that we have a unitary.
There's been a green deal,
yeah. Okay. So I don't have a strong opinion on whether the evolution is unitary or non-unitary. There are reasons to look at whether it's non-unitary, and I've mentioned that. There's also plenty of good reasons to think that it might be unitary. One is just to demand unitary on aesthetic grounds, that, you know, there's no, physicists should know everything, and God is not a gambler. The ADS-TFT gives some fairly good evidence that the interaction might, the fundamental evolution might be unitary. And if we don't want to resort to God or the ADS-TFT correspondence, then there's a work by Banks, Peskin, and Susskind, which I think in some sense killed off a lot of work on non-unitary evolution, because they basically showed that there's a tension between locality and conservation law. And violating conservation law. And that's essentially what I want to talk about in this talk. I want to just explore this tension between locality and conservation laws. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll quickly outline what we know about non-unitary theories, and there your question about the fact that, yes, there's been a lot of work on those sorts of questions about non-unitary theories. But then I'll get to this objection of Banks, Peskin, and Susskind, and explain it quickly, and then suggest a way out of this tension between locality and conservation law. And the way out of that tension is basically to look at relational theories, and I'll explain a bit more about that. And I'll look at that in both the context of quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, etc. I'll also discuss things, I'll discuss a few things. So one is I'll look at Noether's theorem in the context of non-unitary theories. Noether's theorem assumes that we have a unitary evolution. So I'll look at what happens to Noether's theorem if we have a non-unitary evolution. And I'll briefly discuss how we might think about coupling these non-unitary theories to gravity. Although I'm not going to say a lot about that because I suggest a few kind of toy theories, but I don't have a lot to say about how we're going to actually couple these theories.
When you say relational, that's not a word for it, non-local.
Relational, I mean that rather than looking at, I mean that we should look at our observables are not just, say, with respect to an absolute reference frame, but might be with respect to each other. So I might think about measuring the chair relative to measuring apparatus.
So these would be non-local relations.
So I'll explain what we mean by local and non-local, because I think you need to say very clearly what you mean by non-locality. And there's actually two different notions of non-locality that will become important for this talk. And if I have time, I'll discuss these theories are Lorentz invariant in a funny kind of way. And they're also time symmetric. So let me just first say what are the non-unitary theories that I'm going to consider. The most common form is called the Lindblad equation, and it was discovered by Lindblad, but also Kosakowski and others. Can people see the, it's a bit off the page, but that's basically rho dot is equal to essentially your usual Hamiltonian term here, but then you also have what's called this Lindblad term here, and these LKs are called Lindblad operators. And this is the most general form of an evolution we can have if we make certain very basic assumptions, essentially that the theory is what's called Markovian, meaning it has no memory, so it's there's kind of a time translation invariance in some sense. Bounded operator, but also that the map basically takes a density matrix and maps it to another density matrix. So if we have a positive matrix, it maps it to another positive matrix. It preserves the trace, so nothing strange happens in probabilities. So essentially, I can think of it, for example, like flipping a coin and applying some unitaries. Although that's actually maybe a continuous coin flipping and applying something like that. This is a well-known open quantum system equation for describing a non-unitary interaction, which does kind of very little violence to our physical principles that we know of. So an example of a Lindblad evolution, does anyone have a question about the Lindblad evolution? Or is that, I don't know, from a people that know quantum mechanics, it's kind of a very standard evolution, but people in quantum gravity less so, I think.
Maybe the sum of a K, what can you say?
Right. So,
it's just a countable set.
It's just some countable set. You can consider, although it's not done very often, you can actually consider a continuous set as well of Lindblad operators. And there's not much restriction on Lindblad operators at all. You can, just to maybe even make it simpler, you can often see if the Lindblad operators are Hermitian, then this thing is actually just a double commutator. It just looks like an LK row. So it's a double commutator with a minus sign. And it's a real term, so it needs to be K, essentially.
So the classical limit where commutator might go to zero, or at least you can't take double commutators. So the classical limit, this term would vary.
In the classical limit?
Because double commutators basically.
Well, you get something, yeah, you get similar, you can get a similar equation like in an iter equation or something like that, but you wouldn't probably write it as a double commutator, but that's just a way of writing it. I'm not sure how you would.
No, I just think something very elementary. I mean, a single commutator and double commutator differ by 1 power of h bar, and what explains so normally you would. I was just wondering if you were going to use that fact, you know, classical limits, that thing goes away.
And certainly, I can consider in the classical limit, I can consider probabilistic evolution as well. So there's not, at least at this level, there's not necessarily a distinction between quantum limits.
Trace row is not conserved.
Trace row is conserved.
Oh, it is conserved.
I mean, it's very easy to see because you basically have, you know, because the cyclic property under trace, there's a minus sign here, so this thing will, under trace, will be conserved.
Yeah, solution of Markovian process is just very simplistic, right? You don't have any intuition.
I'm going to consider fundamental information destruction. You can make an argument why you should consider a Markovian dynamics, and that's because if it's really fundamental, then I shouldn't have an environment. I shouldn't think of this as an environment. And usually, if it's a non-Markovian process, then it's a bit like a memory effect. And if my evolution is truly fundamental, then one might imagine that there's no memory effects. On the other hand, I can also think of memory as just being a non-locality in time, and then maybe I could include. So I'm considering this because it's just the most, it's just the simplest thing to consider. You could imagine you have a non-Markovian process. You could even imagine that it's not completely trace-preserving, or not completely positive. It could just be positive. Positive meaning it takes a positive matrix to a positive matrix, completely positive, meaning which if you act on part of a system, it'll take a positive matrix to a positive matrix. And we usually demand that it be completely positive because we can act our evolution on part of a quantum system. But if this is a fundamental evolution applying to the whole universe, it's not clear what the other part of the system is. If, you know, the universe is what we got in some sense, and the difference being positive and completely positive is not very interesting. Not that interesting.
Does the T in CPT mean trace preserving?
This or means completely positive trace preserving map.
Yeah.
So I have a question. So
here you're saying there is no environment. So this is the fundamental universe.
I'm claiming, I'm going to explore whether this can be a fundamental interaction without an environment.
So this means that somehow you have to recover the usual situation in quantum mechanics when you have, you know, just a system in the lab that is almost isolated, and we observe that evolution is almost unitary, right? So
yes, that's right.
So where is this almost? Where do you see that this is almost?
Well, we'll get to that. I mean, you don't want to modify physics in that we know of physics. Of course, what we know of physics is that it's a highly non-unitary. I mean, if you look at anything in the lab, it decoheres incredibly quickly, and so the experimental constraints on unitary evolution are probably not that. It's unclear how big the constraints are.
You can certainly evolve for a large number of plant times.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, it would come from probably interference. So an example of non-unitary evolution or an evolution of this form, this Lindblad evolution, is just pure decoherence. So if I take my Lindblad operators to be projectors, say, and now I'm going to talk about first quantum mechanics just to keep things simple, and we'll get to field theory later. If my Lindblad operators are just projectors, and I forget about the Hamiltonian term, and I only have one of them, say, then this is what the evolution is now. What it does is it just leaves the diagonal elements the same, but it kills off the off-diagonal element. So it basically leads to just straight decoherence in a particular basis. And the basis is given by these Lindblad operators. So it's a lot like a measurement. If you imagine a measurement where we basically start with some quantum system which has all kinds of coherences in it, and we perform a measurement, then what we're basically doing is, in a certain basis, we're killing off the off-diagonal elements of the basis. There's no coherence anymore. We just get a classical probabilistic mixture. So we're going from a superposition to a classical mixture, and that's the kind of evolution you get from these Lindblad operators. So you get exponential decay of off-diagonal elements.
How does it work with spin?
In what sense?
With angular momentum.
So the same way. So I mean, if I'm measuring the spin of a particle, it would just kill off the
off diagonal.
Right. So if you had a superposition of up plus down, it would get to a probabilistic mixture of up or down.
But that violates angular momentum very badly.
That's right. That's right.
So you expect multi-order one violations of angular momentum in what sort of experiment?
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
I mean, that's essentially the issue. I mean, what I actually want to discuss is that very question of, can you have a local evolution which as you notice, the measurement appears to violate conservation. So if I measure, let's maybe get to that. I have a, this looks a lot like a measurement. So if we measure, for example, if our Lindblad operators are position operators, so projection on a certain position, then we know that the Lindblad equation here is going to disturb the momentum. In the same way that when we measure position, we disturb the momentum. I'll say it again because it's a very important point, and I think it's the essence of the problem. Non-unitary evolution, a lot of the time, we can think of it just like being a measurement, because we basically decohere the system into a certain basis. We know when we perform a measurement that we disturb a complementary observable. So when we measure position, we disturb the momentum. Now, and this is where you get into problems with conservation law. We know that momentum is conserved, So when we decohere into position, we disturb momentum, and momentum is conserved. How can that be? We're somehow violating the conservation law on momentum. So, for example, Banks, Peskin, and Susskind looked at kind of a interpretation of Hawking's 82 theory, where basically you have, you know, the density matrix, you have the usual Hamiltonian evolution, and then you have what is essentially a Lindblad term here, where you basically have local decoherence given by the Lindblad operators here are just, say, the field, some field observables, electromagnetic field or whatever. And these are local terms, so it's almost like a decoherence into a local field observables, or operators, I should say. And that produces an infinite amount of momentum because you're basically projecting onto essentially a local field observable, which is not going to commute with the total momentum. So is that clear from this? So if you have a local, in other words, if you have a local Lindblad equation with it, where the Lindblad operators are local in X, like here, so both of these Lindblad operators are local in X, you produce a huge amount of momentum because it's essentially like measuring the local field observable.
Okay. Because there's a single X integral in X well, right?
That's right.
I could explore.
Well, yeah, if I look at F mu, it's a scalar.
But that's already seen.
Okay, no, I mean, these things I can assume that they're smeared over some test function or something like that, so I don't want to talk about those kinds of infinities, but just kind of...
Then it's not local? I thought you were fine.
Well, smearing it over some even very tiny area. So this will still, even if I smear it over a very tiny, or even if I smear it over kind of an even larger area, it'll still produce a huge amount of momentum, because I'm essentially measuring I'm measuring a local quantity, and that local quantity cannot commute with the global momentum, which is a global quantity. I mean, you understand it very well when you look at basically a Lindblad equation, which is decohering in the x basis. It's a decoherence into a local quantity, the position, that has to disturb the momentum, because it doesn't commute with the momentum. Is that clear? Because that, I think, needs to be for the rest of this talk. So measuring or decohering into local observables, because the local observables don't commute with the global, with like global conserved things like momentum, you disturb the momentum. This was essentially
what if you actually did f squared of p instead of x, f squared of x, and then integrate over p?
Then it wouldn't be a local equation. And this is the tension. So this is basically exactly the tension that Banks, Peskin, and Susskind brought up. That if my Lindblad operators are local, you'll disturb momentum, for example. And if they are not, if they don't disturb the momentum, then it'll be a non-local equation, non-local evolution. So what they basically said is that all theories are going to suffer from this tension, from this tension between locality, having a local equation of motion and conservation laws. And you could, of course, decohere into boring observables like the total momentum, but that would be very boring. So let's go back to quantum mechanics, because there seems to be, and this is sort of how this started, it seems to be a bit of a puzzle here, because I just said it's like measuring the position of a particle. And if you measure the position of a particle, we disturb the momentum and appear to violate momentum conservation. So how is it that we can, I mean, we measure position all the time. How is it that we measure position without violating momentum conservation? And this was actually discussed, I didn't write down the reference here, but especially Aronoff and Susskind. And what we essentially do is we don't actually measure the position of a particle. What we do is we measure the position of the particle relative to the position of the measuring apparatus. So we basically have what we're really measuring. So P and X don't commute. But if I look at, say, X of a system minus X of a reference system, that commutes with the total momentum of the reference system plus the momentum of the system. So the total momentum commutes with the difference in position of the system relative to the ruler or the reference. And that is why, in ordinary experiments in the lab, we can measure position and without violating the conservation laws, because we're actually measuring the relative position. Okay, so before I get to this relational approach, which I just touched upon, I just should say a bit about the previous literature. So after the Banks, Peshin, and Susskind argument, there were some attempts to kind of circumvent them. Probably Andrew and Wald in 95 is probably the most well known, where they basically bumped up the violations of energy and momentum conservation to a kind of a high energy scale, below the Planck scale, but kind of well above what we would see in the lab. That's a similar approach that's been taken by Poonen and John Presko recently. You can also maybe introduce, as I said, Markovian effects, non-Markovian effects, or there may be other ways to do it, but I'm going to look at this one. So the idea is we're going to go to a relational theory, and what we want to do is we want to measure not x, or we want to decohere not into an observable like the position, but we want to decohere into a relative, basically a relative observable. So for example, before we looked at a Lindblad operator like a projection onto x. And if we have a Lindblad operator, which is a projection onto x, then we're going to disturb the momentum of the particle. So what I want to do is to add extra degrees of freedom. I'm going to have two particles. And now I'm going to, instead of projecting onto x, I'm going to project onto the case where particle 1 is at x and particle 2 is at x. But I don't care where they are. So I integrate over all x. So I'm this observable here. So particle 1 is at x and particle 2 is at x. But I don't know where in absolute space they are. This observable is like a coincidence detector, right? It basically just measures, are the two particles, if I'm thinking of it as a measurement operator, it's are the two particles together or not? If it's in a Lindblad equation, it basically just does nothing when the two particles are far apart. When the two particles are together, it does decohere. So basically, decohere is the situation where the two particles are together or the two particles are far apart. Furthermore, it commutes with a total momentum. And that's quite clear because I'm integrating over all space. So for example, if I translate this operator by a position x, I get back the same operator, right? Because translating by x is not going to do anything to this thing because I'm integrating over all of this. So this thing is unaffected by a translation in x, so it clearly commutes with a total momentum. So now, if I put this into a Lindblad equation, I have a Lindblad equation where I don't violate momentum conservation of these two particles. It's local in the sense that, you know, nothing happens until the two particles are together. So there's no violation of locality. And I have conservation of momentum. So on the quantum mechanical level, it's very easy to get operators which conserve momentum and yet are still local. Are there any questions at this point?
Are you trying to argue what to promote one of those two particles to an observer? Or
Well, I don't. So I could think of, if I wanted to, I could think of one of these particles as being a detector. But if I'm thinking about some fundamental evolution laws, I want to basically stick these operators in a Lindblad equation, and then there's clearly nature doesn't know what a reference system is and what is the system that I'm interested in. So in some sense, I can think of one of these particles as a reference system, and this is just measuring are the two particles, but this is really just measuring are the two particles together, and I don't need to think of one of them as a measuring apparatus and the other one is the system. It's just two particles.
But that's how you're motivating. I mean, that's how we should think.
Well, it's a way to think about what, I mean, because there's, you know, it's I mentioned it because when you hear about the result of this kind of this result of Banks, Pesson, and Susskind, where you see that you get a violation of conservation law if you kind of decohere into something local, it should immediately ask the question, well, how is it that we in real life we seem to be able to measure local things without violating conservation laws? Because the two, both the decoherence and the measuring, are very similar. And if we get a if there's a contradiction with a non-unitary evolution, then there ought to be a contradiction when it comes to ordinary measurement theory.
And what's the Hamiltonian in this case? Just zero? Or?
In this case, yeah, it's just zero.
It's a similar question. What happens to the total energy?
In this case, the total energy will be a problem. So this does not commute with the total energy. What we'll see we need to do is basically for every conservation law, at least in the quantum mechanics case, you need to add an extra particle and kind of do this integration, essentially.
You might have to integrate over time if you want.
You will, and
it'll be some time.
Yeah, and I'll show how to deal with that. So you're pointing out, that's a good question, and you're pointing out that energy and time seem to be actually on a different footing than all the other conservation laws, and I'll show how, we have to deal with that in a different way, and I'll show how to deal with that. So let's go back to Hawking's 82 theory. So we remember we had basically the usual Hamiltonian term, and then we had this decoherence term, which was decohering into the local field. And the Lindblad operator, this LX here, is just a local field operator. And that led to huge violation of momentum conservation. So what we're instead going to do, instead of considering this LX into the local field, what we're going to do is consider basically a reference system, which in this case is just a Schrodinger particle. And I'm now basically looking at a hybrid quantum mechanics, quantum field theory case. I'll go to the full field theory in a moment. And then we have the field observable, the local field observable here. So I'll say again, rather than decohering and having Lindblad operators which are local fields, we have local fields. We're basically a local field tensor, say some the position of a quantum mechanical particle, and we integrate over all space. For the same reason as before, this operator conserves momentum. We're integrating over all space, and so if you translate by an amount x, this operator doesn't change. Therefore, it commutes with the total momentum, so it conserves momentum. It's also local. It only acts at the, you only get decoherence at the place of the field, you only get decoherence of the field at the place where this particle is. So I can think of it like I have a quantum mechanical particle and a field, and wherever the quantum mechanical particle is, I get decoherence on the field observable. And that is a little bit, in some ways we can, of course, think of this as a black hole, but you can kind of you can imagine it as a toy black hole in the sense where you have, the position of the black hole, and wherever the black hole is, you get decoherence, and the whole thing will conserve momentum because, in some sense, it's it commutes with the momentum of the field and of the black hole.
So is that the most general operator which would do this? You can make lots of these things now, is it?
That's right. Yeah, so you can go to town and,
what's the essential part of that structure which you do this for you?
Okay, so it's called, in quantum information theory, this would be called twirling. So here, this thing would be called twirling. Namely, we take some operator, which might not commute with the conserved quantity we want. We then, we take our operator, and then we do what's called twirling, which essentially means that we take, if we have some generator of a symmetry, then we basically act it on our operator. And integrate over all instances of the generator. So this will make it basically invariant under the action of the group. So for a group, which, so for a generator of a particular symmetry, we basically just integrate it over all infinitesimal evolutions under that group, under that generator.
It's like instead of making something gauge invariant by modding over the gauge, you sum over all the gauge copy.
Somehow, it's a way of doing that, I suppose. It mods out over kind of, it's something you can think of it like, I have the symmetry because I don't, the reason I have a symmetry because it doesn't depend on the absolute point in space. And so what I should do is I should just kind of integrate over all possible places where the origin can be. And that gives me an operator which is conserves momentum. So given any observable that I choose, I can basically integrate out over all, you know, over the various symmetries that I'm interested in kind of conserving, and that will conserve the quantities that I'm interested that are associated with that symmetry.
So before you go on to the next slide, I would like to ask a question to see if I'm interpreting these formulas correctly. In the original Hawking model from 82, there was a continuous family of these Lindblad operators that appear in the equation, one for each x. Do I understand correctly that in your new model, you have just one single Lindblad operator, which is this Q?
What you probably want to do is have a whole bunch of them. So what I can do is take, what I probably want to do is take any local field observer, local field operator. So phi, pi, phi squared, pi, phi, whatever. And use all of those. And that gets into something which you can kind of consider as a richness problem, which is, are those observables all interesting? Do those observables give us an interesting enough structure?
Right.
And certainly in the case where you have a quantum mechanical limit, they do, because in this case, we see that we basically get everything that's interesting in the sense that this looks exactly, you know, if I have a quantum particle in a particular place, then this will, with just the one Lindblad operator, I get exactly what I would have got in the original Hawking model. But only at the place where, say, the black hole is or the quantum mechanical particle is. Does that answer your question, Don?
I think it does. So you're saying that if you wanted to reproduce the full physics of the original Hawking model, you would need something like an infinite collection of particles and an infinite collection of these Lindblad operators.
No, I think I'm saying in the case where I have a quantum limit. So in this case here, where I have a hybrid theory, I mean, I may be saying that, but in the case where I have a quantum particle here, then I only need one.
But as you say, you only reproduce the physics of the original Hawking story at the location of that part.
That's right. So where I have the black hole, for example, if I want to think of it as kind of a black hole toy, where I have that black hole toy, I'll get the full decoherence that I get in the Hawking model at the place where the black hole is. But I won't get it at other points in space.
Very good.
If I want to start having it at other points in space, then I think you're probably right. I need a huge number. That's something that I don't think is being explored. You know, it's not quite clear what these set of observables are, whether they're what they contain, but there are a huge amount of them. It's all local observables that can be controlled by this. Right, and I've said to you that, so just this summarizes. So this just summarizes essentially that in the full quantum field theory, we basically add extra fields, so we want things to be interesting. So we want to kind of have things which look like reference systems and things that aren't. So we add a bunch of extra fields into our theory, and then we basically do this. We take any local permission operator, say, actually don't use permission, but we take any local operators, and then we do this twirling where we basically integrate, say, over X or whichever symmetry we're interested in. So just some examples. You can actually, at the beginning I gave this quantum mechanical model where you had, you know, a coincidence detector. You can get that at some limit, some non-relativistic limit of a field, set of field operators for a scalar field. Just mention that. Now, I kind of waved my hands to say that this thing was local, and I guess I wanted to get to the point of what do you mean by locality? And I want to distinguish between two kinds of locality. And the first kind is, I think what people usually mean, which is just causality. So if I have, if I had in my new theory, if I have two operators, which are space-like separated, if they commute, they should basically commute if they are space-like. That's the first notion of locality, so causality, essentially. The second notion of non-locality is about non-local correlations. And a way of phrasing that mathematically is that imagine if I have two operators, one at x and one at y, and I look at how it evolves, it should evolve as a product. In other words, so dABDT should evolve as, you know, so dABDT should evolve as A dot B plus AB dot, essentially. So that essentially is talking now about looking at correlations in theory.
Isn't that how you applied by the first?
It turns out not.
Wait, if you have a Hamiltonian which is an integral of a local density, then I commute the Hamiltonian with the left-hand side, and right. then I get the right-hand side automatically if condition one.
That's right. So for Hamiltonian evolution, number one implies number two.
Okay.
For Limbaugh evolution, it turns out that number one does not imply number two. Yeah, so as you said, I can just look at that, how the Hamiltonian commutes with these things and see that this is implied. When I have the double commutator say, you get extra terms.
Sorry, what is meant by the evolution of an operator? So, I mean, in the Lindblad equation, you're evolving a density matrix.
So
if it's unitary, that can be just switched over to an evolutionary
right.
operator. But
here, you can also look at that. So just like in unitary evolution, I can have a Schrodinger picture with us. And a Heisenberg picture. Here as well, I can have a Schrodinger picture and a Heisenberg picture. There's some subtleties.
Then you learn the commutation relations much among the operators.
Well, I mean, it is, you know, I need to look at how these operators evolve, and they may, you know, obviously the evolution will be different, so the commutation relations between times will be different. But there still is a Heisenberg picture, and you can switch back.
Can you go back to the previous question? I was still confused about it. Can I see that equation again?
Which one?
Yeah, just this equation. I think I didn't understand the answer to the last question. If you have a product of two operators A and B,
yes.
the change of the delta of AB almost tautologically is delta A times B plus A times delta B. It doesn't have to be time evolution or anything, right?
There's a question about how these things time evolve. So if these things will develop correlations, for example. So basically, if these things develop correlations, then it's not going to be true that they evolve in. I mean, it's basically about the independence of their evolution. So if I have two observables which get correlated, then it won't be true that they evolve like this product.
But if A and B are just two matrices, you're saying it's not true that delta of AB is equal to delta AB plus...
Right, because the evolution is not about... I mean, they don't evolve independently necessarily.
So the evolution of A is affected by the presence of B, of your trying to measure B.
No, so it's a bit subtle. So I think that was what people assumed. They assumed that this signaled a breakdown in causality. This in itself does not signal a breakdown in causality. So I guess the point, so it goes both ways. You can have causality without having, and still having a violation of two, this product rule. And likewise, you can have a violation of this product rule and you still have causality. So just because you have a violation of this kind does not mean that you have a more serious violation of causality. It's a little bit subtle, but maybe the best way to explain it is like this. We want to preserve one, and we don't want to mess with causality. But say I had a theory which started producing correlated particles. I mean, the vacuum itself is highly correlated, but what if in addition it started giving me, say, singlets out of thin air? Would that be, that's not a violation of causality, simply because you can't use that to signal. But it is a kind of a non-locality in the sense that you're producing these correlated things.
Even one you could want to get up at a small enough distance, mm-hmm. at extreme enough circumstance.
Sorry.
If you would do quantum gravity, then one you might want to allow to give up
causality,
at least in some flunking sense.
Right. I mean, it's very difficult to control the Plunkian sense because we kind of know that these things tend to kind of peak out.
Which is partly what black holes might be doing.
Right.
At the left-hand side, you mean that just you have the, you first take the product of the operators A and B, and then you evolve in time, right? And then you take the derivative.
That's, sorry, the left-hand side there?
Yes.
Yeah, it's operator A, B.
So, no, what I mean, as A, B is a function of time,
you have evolution of the joint operator.
Of it, yeah, that's it's not like you have A of T and B of T.
That's right.
That's what somebody, the second, the right-hand side will be sent automatically. If you first take the joint operator that you evolve, then it's,
that's right.
I think the condition, I mean, at later times, A, B will not be the product of A and B.
That's certainly true. Right. Which is how fast does it happen? Okay. So to prove causality, I have to, I've got 5 minutes, 10 minutes. Okay, so just to go quickly. To prove causality, you can essentially prove causality by creating a fictitious environment. I mean, you can basically purify, you can look at the unitary theory, trace out an environment, and get the Lindblad equation that I want. And because the original theory is fully relativistic and respects causality, just throwing stuff into the garbage cannot affect, cannot make the theory less causal. So you can prove causality that way. I should say about the environment is completely crazy, which is why it's a good thing that we think of this thing as being fundamental non-unitarity and not really think of this environment as being real. It's quite clearly a fictitious environment. So it has infinite spatial correlations, infinitely many fields. It doesn't take up any momentum or energy with the real system that we're looking at. So it doesn't exchange charge. It doesn't exchange any charges with this thing. So in many senses, it's kind of a completely fictitious environment, but it allows us to prove that we respect causality. The theory does have these non-local creation or destruction of correlations. So you do basically have a term which violates this product rule. The term, as far as we can tell, looks fairly benign. It's fairly small. It would be difficult to detect experimentally, but it's there. And I'll just maybe just quickly mention that it might be interesting to kind of think of it in the context of the CMB. We usually think of the horizon problem as saying that we have 2 points in, you know, that are space-like separated, which are correlated at the same temperature, and we say that violates causality. That's a problem. Our theory must have supraluminal signaling. That's not the case. That's not. You can have correlations in space-like between space-like separated points, which can appear but do not violate causality. So this theory seems to have those kinds of correlations. And it might be interesting to explore that in relation to kind of the horizon problem without resorting to something like inflation. Raphael mentioned that time translation is a bit different, and that's true. So for time translation, the reason you have a difference is that two Lindblad operators, or two operators, will commute if they're in different points in space. But if they're different points in time, but at the same point in space, they don't commute. And that leads to a difference. You have to treat time differently than you treat, say, all the other symmetries. And another way to think of that is that time appears on the left-hand side of the Lindblad equation. So you, in some sense, can have a relational time and this kind of, I guess, artificial parameter time which refers to absolute space. So you need to basically get rid of this thing which refers to absolute space.
So this is true also for the pure decoherence model, or?
Yes, I mean, what is true?
The point one. The time
translation. Oh, I see. Another way of saying why time translation is special when you're modifying evolution equations is because, you know, so spatial translations are generated by the momentum. Time translations used to be generated by the Hamiltonian. They're not anymore. They're now generated by the Snellenberger operation.
No, but it's because you are losing energy or not? This is my question.
The time translation is generated not by the Hamiltonian?
Yes.
Not necessarily. It's just because it's not time evolution is no longer given by Hamilton. I mean, you have a freedom. You have a freedom to change the evolution law, so you can change what generates time translation. You cannot change, for example, what generates spatial translation. Well, because it's a tautology that d rho dx is the commutator of p.
And the same, I could say the same about d rho dx.
Well, no, because if I actually take p and act it on a field, for example, if I take the momentum, there isn't a momentum operator, which when I act on the field, it actually gives me d phi dx. Whereas if I take the Hamiltonian, it doesn't give me d phi dt. It's
suppose if I would be, for example, in the sitter space, where there is a de Sitter horizon that depends on the observer.
Right.
If I then translate the observer, the horizon shifts along with it.
Right.
And one might be tempted to say, okay, well, that actually means that that particular generator has some mixing between pure and mixed states as well.
Well, the thing is that if I look at, well, I guess in, say in the context of a Lorentz transformation, which I think might be suggestive of the same thing, you don't have, a vector which is time-like stays time-like. So if I have decoherence in the time-like direction and a different kind of evolution in the space-like direction, then the Lorentz transformation is not going to change that.
Don't force it.
Right. I don't have enough time to really give this justice, but what you really want to do to get energy conservation is basically what you basically need to divide essentially your Hamiltonian. I mean, this problem is an old problem in some sense. You divide your Hamiltonian into kind of some, you find some cloth degree of freedom, which it can be is a problem often, but you can usually find some approximate clock. We now impose time translation invariance on the state, so that our state shouldn't depend on this external time, because it's not a real physical thing. It's just some parameter that doesn't, God maybe knows what it is, but it's not a physical thing. So because it's not physical, our state shouldn't depend on it. So we demand basically what is effectively a Wheeler-DeWitt type equation. And that just comes about from imposing time translation invariance on quantum mechanics. So Wheeler-DeWitt equation is not, arises in any quantum theory as well. And if you do that, you automatically get a Lindblad equation with respect to this clock, which conserves energy and is also local, which is also local. And that just comes about automatically. And I mean, maybe this is for after. I don't really.
Yeah. I mean, it's local. Okay. Local in what sense? It's local in terms of space.
It's local in terms of space. It's local in time as well, in the sense that it's completely not local with respect to this fictitious t,
right,
but it's local with respect to this physical time tau. And of course, I don't care about local in. I mean, I don't care about. There's no meaning to saying that whether it's local in little x, meaning this kind of fictitious reference frame, or fictitious gods, absolute space. But like absolute space and absolute time, I don't care about locality with respect to that, because it's not a physical thing. I care about whether it's local in time with respect to kind of physical observables. And I care about whether something is local in space by looking at the commutation relations, not with, you could argue that any, if I take this thing, dx, and I take this operator here, it doesn't look local because compared to the absolute reference frame, it's not. It's integrated over all space in absolute space. But it's still a local observable in the sense that it commutes everywhere except with observables at a particular point.
So you're saying that it's local?
This thing here, Q.
Q bar, yeah.
Yes. So it's local in the sense, so look at this thing here. This thing looks non-local because it's integrated over all space. But but it'll just disappear. But now, if I look at, say, the commutator with some other observable, say, A of Y, this will commute everywhere except at X and Y, you know, except at Y. So I'll basically get something which is proportional to some to a delta function, some X minus Y. So it only so it commutes everywhere except at that point Y essentially.
Sorry, what does that mean? X minus Y.
Yeah, yeah. What I mean is that this basically is equal to some local operator at Y. So it's non-local if you look at it in terms of absolute space, but if I look at the commutator with any local observable at Y, it equals some local observable at Y, local operator at Y.
Is that also true for the Q bar? Is that what you mean?
That's also true for the Q bar. Not in absolute space and time, but in the time given by the clock. And it's very easy to see that because, I mean, it's, in some sense, it's just, so I have a Q with outer bar, which means, and so this does need a bit more time to really, so I have some Q at a particular time here. I mean, this Q bar is basically some Q at a particular time, external time, integrated over all times.
But this Q at a later time, this also not commute with the field.
That's right. So Q at any other time looks completely. So Q of t is local at, say, t equals 0,
right.
But it's not local at any other time,
so
t.
Yeah, so doesn't that give you a problem?
Yeah, so Q bar by itself is completely non-local. But when I now look at it at a particular time tau, given by this clock here, it becomes local again because it essentially projects onto that particular time that I'm looking at it. There's a way to do as follows.
So you're actually sandwiching.
I have a clock essentially. So I have some clock observable, and this thing which is.
But you're looking at the equation then by sandwiching between tt, between that state.
Yeah, I mean this thing acts on the system and some clock degrees of freedom that I've selected out. So I can separate out I separate out the total system into the system. Plus some clock degrees of freedom. And then this thing basically acts at the time given by the clock at the appropriate time when this operator is still local. And that comes out automatically. That's not put in by hand, but that comes about because we're essentially selecting by our selecting of a good clock. So once we've chosen a good clock, then you get this.
So you're now saying that this evolution law manifestly commutes with H.
That's right.
Now, yeah, there's sort of a general argument for why any thing, any non-unitary evolution should violate energy conservation, simply because of the fact that energy for the cats, or at least one problem it has is maybe more strongly stated, is that the vacuum is not stable. Because the cat part of the
right.
Has negative energy when measured relative. At least the cat, and they have opposite energy. Meaning, if one of them has a positive spectrum,
okay, sure.
The other one in some in that same unit
right.
Has a negative spectrum.
Right.
And as soon as you have an evolution that mixes the two,
right,
you kind of create an infinite sink of energy.
Right. I mean, in this case, there's no clock there, right? So in some sense, when this thing acts, it does nothing at all. I mean, it won't do anything to the vacuum.
Yeah.
But then again, there's also no degrees of freedom to call a clock, so...
But you're claiming here that you're kind of resolving that issue, or...?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, this thing commutes with the total Hamiltonian, so it will...
Although I guess...
I mean, you couldn't... So for the vacuum, you couldn't single out this clock degree of freedom here. But the theory itself would, I mean, these operators do commute for the total Hamiltonian, but you can't pick out a clock.
Although the clock can absorb a very large amount of energy.
That's right.
And that's the equivalent of
that's right. Yes. I'm out of time, but let me just say one last thing, which is, of course, the important thing, I mean, although maybe I need to kind of step back, we've been talking about respecting conservation laws. What you really want to respect is the symmetry. You know, the reason we have momentum conservation is because we have time translation invariance. That's more important. And another theorem is actually derived using through unitarity. I mean, you basically, you get the conservation law from the symmetry if you assume unitarity. If you assume non-unitarity, it's not, you need to kind of look at what you get. And it actually turns out that it's very restrictive. So if you look at, if you actually look at the Lindblad equation and look at what happens under a symmetry, you do get a very specific restriction on the kind of evolution. So in particular, the Hamiltonian still needs to commute with the generator of the symmetry. And the Lindblad operators either need to commute with the symmetry, the generator of the symmetry, or they're just simple raising or lowering operators. So you get a very you get a very tight restriction on the on the nodes there, which leads to a very kind of you can get violations of conservation, but at a very small level, so kind of linear, not exponential in time, but very linear. And I just go with this. You can get modifications, not speaking in more generality, you can get modifications of the continuity equation, which does also necessarily lead to modifications in gravity, because we have a Bianchi identity which is going to basically if you have a modification of the conservation equation, you will also get the modification through gravity through the Bianchi identity. You must get something. So it might be interesting to explore the kind of modifications you would get to Einstein's equations if you had such a kind of evolution. So let me just quickly summarize. So basically, we found that if we want to respect conservation laws, we are forced into a relational framework. We don't have a choice. This relational model allows us to resolve at least some of the conflicts between locality and conservation laws, which have played a lot of attempts to kind of look for a non-unitary theory. In part, it was because we clarified what we mean by locality. So there's two kinds of locality. There's the causality, meaning the theory shouldn't allow us to signal supraluminally. These theories respect that kind of locality. But there's also a locality when we talk about correlations. And this theory can create or destroy correlations in a manner which we're not used to. It doesn't violate causality, but it violates some of our intuitions about correlations in space like this. There's a generalized Noether's theorem. I should say this evolution is time symmetric. And actually, in terms of measurement theory, these spontaneous collapse models, it does resolve many of the problems that plague some of those if people are interested in these spontaneous collapse models. Probably not here, but for people that are, it does resolve a lot of the problems that plague those models.
So just one second before we go to this next slide. When you said it can generate correlations across points which you didn't expect, maybe you said this, what sets the length scale of that, or is that up to you?
So these are scale invariants in this case. Okay, so yeah, because you're integrating over all, so scale invariant correlations. And then finally, sorry, just there's so many open questions, it's maybe silly to even mention them, but I didn't really look at much at how you couple this to gravity, how it would modify gravity. Don, I think, raised an interesting question about whether these set of observables, maybe implied it, that how rich are these observables, these relational observables? Can we describe everything we see through relational observables? I think that's a reasonable question. I'll end there. The chair is getting.
Questions
already. Are there some short questions?
So the question that was asked at the beginning, I'm not quite convinced. So if I'm supposed to think of this as a theory of gravity, right, the natural time scale that goes into your equation is like 5 times, right? And we've observed in the lab that we can keep coherence for 10 to 40 times time, right? So if you want to make sense of this theory, you have to suppress the lambda equation operators by like a crazy number, right? So that's, isn't that fine tuning?
Depending on your theory. So in this case, I mean, if I, so naively, you could just tune this parameter gamma, which is in the lambda equation. And in that case, it's just, it's tuned to be small.
But like, the tuning is like, I'm doing it 10 to 40, you can do.
Well, so take a look at the one I did where, for example, I had a model where you only had decoherence at the point where this particle was. So there you see nothing until you're close to one of these particles. So if I modeled, say, a black hole like that, then I would see nothing except at the point where the black hole is. Likewise, if you look at some of the the models of, say, Winron-Wald or Poulin and Preskill, there you kind of bump it up to higher energy scales, you don't see them more.
Can you, I was very interested, you said that you don't violate causality, by which you meant you can't signal.
Right.
So what does that mean exactly? What are you allowing the signaler to do? When you say that it doesn't violate, you can't send signals.
Right.
So you must have proved some theorem, or you must have, I mean, why is that true? You just said it.
I just said you can't signal.
You said
signal.
You can't signal, but what did you
yes. So basically what you have to do is you need to construct it. So what we do is we construct the model, which leads to this non-unitary evolution, which is fully unitary. So we construct a relativistic field theory, which if we trace out the certain fields, we get this lambda evolution. So because the full theory is relativistic and Lorentz invariant doesn't allow signaling, throwing away fields and not looking at fields can't allow you to signal either.
So that's the argument.
Yeah, I mean, if you can't signal in the full theory, you certainly can't signal if you don't look at certain fields. That's just making it harder for you, not easier.
So it's, you didn't, I mean, I was wondering if you had a general definition of what signaling would mean, but you bypassed it in the sense that you just started from a theory that you knew didn't have signaling.
Yeah, I'm not sure about
it. I mean, suppose someone just gave you some lambda equations, how would you know?
I would try and construct it. That's what we did. We started with a lambda equation, which conserved momentum and had these properties that we wanted, and then we, from that, constructed a theory which it can come from. So you need to try it. I mean, that's one way to do it. There's presumably other ways to do it. Well, there are other ways to do it as well, but I think they're harder.
So, these Q bars commute with the Hamiltonian.
That's right.
And do they also commute with time translation with the clock time, tau?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, since the Hamiltonian is not generating time translations anymore, so I want to know if these Lindblad operators that you're constructing are.
They commute with basically H. So if you want to break it up into the clock and the system, you
right.
With a full Hamiltonian H0 plus H of the clock.
Right. What I'm asking is if they stay the same under time translation, then it seems to me that they're not interesting, right? That you decoherent that basis, but then it stays decoherent in that basis. How do we ever tell that anything is going on?
Well, it's the same problem that you get in kind of problem of time in quantum theory of gravity. So there's no, and the essentially, if I look at my clock, these things evolve with respect. They do evolve with respect to the clock.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. So they with the translation of clock, they change.
That's right.
Okay.
So let me elaborate on that. These Q bars, as you say, commute with your full Hamiltonian, but they don't commute with your H0 or your pi. So if they don't commute with H0, and if you're thinking of this clock as some fictitious degree of freedom that doesn't really exist, then I'm curious, is there a physical sense in which energy is conserved? And I think that if I measure the energy of this system, what I'm measuring is H0, and that isn't going to commute with your Q.
No, you're right. I actually misspoke. It does commute with
I don't believe it does.
No, it doesn't. It commutes with the full energy. So
that's right.
So what is conserved is the full is the full energy of the universe essentially is conserved. But it's there will be a transfer of energy between from the clock and the
it's your garbage can.
The clock is acting like a garbage can. Just like when I measure the position of a particle, there's a bit of a back reaction on the measuring system, which helps you conserve.
So do you think that's sufficient for our physical need of energy conservation?
Well, I would say you don't have any physical need for energy conservation. The generator of time translation is not given by the Hamiltonian anymore, so why should you conserve energy? But so in some sense it becomes an experimental question. I don't know. I mean, people have different aesthetics. Am I happy that I conserve the total energy? You might be happy that you conserve the total energy. You might be dissatisfied that energy is being transferred from one system to another. But I'm not. Why should I be upset that energy is being transferred from one system to another?
Energy is very well conserved.
It's a question of experiment, and not only questions about experiment that we've actually done as far as measuring the energy of systems and watching it be apparently conserved in time. This also relates to questions of thermodynamics. Right. If there is energy exchange between the visible degrees of freedom and these clock degrees of freedom, that'll surely change the thermodynamic behavior of visible fields.
Well, I mean, we have energy and momentum being transferred all the time between things. So the question is, what do you? No.
Between real things, right?
Well, these are real things. I mean, this, you know, I'm basically just arbitrarily selecting out a clock degree of freedom. So essentially, you get transfer. You know, you will get basically momentum and energy being moved around the system. And what you call your clock and what you don't is completely arbitrary. That can be very small. So from the experimental point of view, I don't think you would notice that. And I don't think you're any more bothered if this theory transfers energy momentum than if, because we know that this is getting, energy and momentum is getting transferred all the time. I'm not sure why you'd be more bothered by this than by, say, usual Hamiltonian evolution.
Maybe the point is, what is the clock?
It could be it's an arbitrary.
That'll make a big difference, presumably. So
yeah, I mean,
particular way the theory looks. So.
Well, the system in some sense doesn't know what the clock is, so that is a matter of choice. It's more that if you want to write down your evolution equation is essentially just d rho dt equals zero. So it's a matter of writing down. The evolution equation, and that you do it by choosing a clock and writing down this thing, which is what we do with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I mean, the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is boring. By singling out some degrees of freedom that we call the clock, we get something which again starts to look interesting. And that, so I don't think this. So sure, it's a bit of a head game, but I don't think it's more of a head game here than it is in say the Wheeler-DeWitt equation.
Well, I'm really confused. When you wrote down the Lisbon equation, you actually changed the physics of the system, but by adding those terms. Are you saying here you haven't touched the physics?
No, I've changed the physics, but
it doesn't matter which term you select, how you select.
Right, so you're getting that equation regardless of which thing you select. Presumably, I mean, presumably by picking tau, you may have some by picking some observables, you might get different. Energy transfer.
So what is the new to change the physics? You just set d rho dt to zero? Is that the new physics?
Well, d rho dt, I think, in any, I mean, if t is just an observable, if it's a absolute time, which is no longer physical, then I think any theory should have d rho dt equal zero. The question then is just how do you write the evolution, the internal degrees of freedom, essentially, in your theory?
Okay, I think we're squeezing the coffee break here. We're a bit drawing behind, so thanks again to Jonathan.